All right, here we go. Thanks for that, Sheila. That's actually going to dovetail with something we're going to be doing today, but it's going to take us a little while to get there. So I will come back to that, though, so thanks for sharing that. Some of you are probably familiar with Bob Dylan. When Bob Dylan was a young artist just breaking into the music scene, the civil rights movement was underway. And Bob Dylan started writing songs that sort of jived with that movement's message. Am I still coming through? Okay. As he's writing these songs, they became known as protest songs, and he sort of joined the civil rights movement. He was protesting not only segregation, but eventually war and some other political things going on. This became part of what Bob Dylan did. So he wrote songs like Blowin' in the Wind and The Times Are a-Changin', and the result is that he became someone who was known as the voice of his generation, and he became known as sort of a prophet. Well, moving on in his career, Bob Dylan has a conversion experience, and he becomes a born-again Christian. And shortly after that, as he's playing in concerts, he's getting different reactions now, partly as a result of the way that he's now speaking. And the public opinion about him starts to change. And so this is, I'm going to read you something that he speaks in a concert in reaction to public opinion about him changing. He said, "Years ago, they said I was a prophet. I used to say, I'm not a prophet. And they would say, yes, you are, you're a prophet. He said, no, it's not me. But they used to keep telling me that I was a prophet, and they convinced me that I was a prophet. And now I come out and I say, Jesus Christ is the answer. And they say, Bob Dylan's no prophet." That's about par for the course for prophets. And something similar is happening in our passage today. Prophets frequently get rejected when people don't like what it is that they are saying, or who they are, or who they have become. I hope that you have the text open today, because I'm going to be looking at it in a great deal of detail, and I'm probably going to say some things that are going to be new to some of you, but they are right there in the text. So please do have it open so that you can hold me accountable and so that you can see it for yourselves. So Matthew 13, starting at verse 54. To put this in context, Jesus has just finished speaking in parables. His parables, if you weren't here last week, his parables are a response. They are, they're trying to do two things. One is they are trying to explain to people why Jesus is starting to get a mixed reaction. Jesus was an incredibly popular prophet at first, and the further along in his ministry that he goes, the public response starts to change. At first, he's really popular, but the response becomes really mixed. He starts to get some very different reactions. Some Pharisees, some leaders start really opposing him. They start questioning how he has the ability to do what he's doing. And so the parable of the soils, the parable of the sower, is an explanation for why it is that people are responding the way that they are. Some people are just in love with Jesus, and other people aren't so sure, and other people are outright rejecting him, and that's what that parable is about. But secondly, it's also a response to that reaction. Some people are going to dig in their heels, and the parable is going to make them do so even further, and for other people, it's going to draw them in. It's doing this at the same time. So that's the context for what has been happening and what Jesus has been doing. So once he's finished giving the parables, Jesus then moves on. And it's been a really hard week. People have really started opposing Jesus. And he's had a hard week. And as you'll see in the text, Jesus goes home. Now, when I was a young teenager, my dad used to travel rather frequently. About once a month, he would leave Hamilton and he'd fly down to either usually Louisiana or Alabama, and he'd spend about a week there, which was where his company had a variety of offices, so he had work that he always had to do down there. But once a week, he'd be away. Well, as kids, we would often give my dad the gears about the fact that he was traveling and away from home and going somewhere warm and nice while leaving, you know, the snow behind in Hamilton. And we'd sometimes tease him that he was going down to visit his other family down in the States. He didn't like this. But, you know, he took it pretty well most of the time. Well, one time, we were teasing him about it. He'd just come home from his vacation down in Birmingham, Alabama, or something like that. And we're teasing him about how he's been spending a great deal of time with his family and probably going to the beach and so on. And he just, all of a sudden, he's like, just becomes so exasperated. Like, I think he had a harder week than normal. He's like, guys, like, I just come home for love, support, and affection. What is going on? Well, this just became a phrase in our house. We used to then give my dad the gears about how he'd come home for love, support, and affection. But, we were rotten kids, and this is how we show love, and sorry about that, we're messed up. But anyway, my dad had a hard week, and he came home looking for something, and he didn't get what he was expecting. Jesus has just had a really tough time with a group of people that aren't so sure of who he is and what he's doing, and they're not just passively resisting him, some of them. Some of them are actively opposing him. That's the context for what has been happening with Jesus. And he goes to his hometown. It's not specific in the text what his hometown is. So do any of you know what Jesus' hometown was? Nazareth. I'm hearing some people might be saying Bethlehem. If you're saying Bethlehem, let me just clarify. Jesus is born in Bethlehem, right? We have, you know, the Christmas story. Jesus is born in Bethlehem, but why does he leave Bethlehem? What happens? Herod wants to kill Jesus. Herod has found out that the king of the Jews has been born, and he's pretty sure that he's actually the king of the Jews and doesn't want someone competing for the throne. So he tries to kill Jesus by wiping out all of the infants in Bethlehem. Jesus' family is warned that they've got to get out of there, and so they flee where? They go down to Egypt. I'm glad that you guys are getting the right answer, because this is stuff we've covered. They go down to Egypt. They go down, and what would their status be as people entering Egypt? Refugees. Imagine that. So Jesus' family flees a country known for political and religious-based terrorism and enters a foreign country where, if at customs, that country decides that we are not going to accept refugees from a country known for political and religious terrorism, which Palestine is in the ancient world, we are not here today, friends. If that country issues a travel ban, we're not here today. I'm going to move on because this is a side note, but I did want to make it explicit because it's right there in the narrative, and you can't argue with that history. That's just the historical context of Jesus moving from Bethlehem to Egypt. And when they've been in Egypt for a little while, they're told that they can safely return, and they don't go to Bethlehem. They settle in Nazareth. So, Nazareth. Nazareth is in the north. Nazareth is in the middle of nowhere. And we've talked about Nazareth before. Nazareth is podunk. Podunk Galilee. Nazareth, archaeologists have discovered, is all of 60 acres. So to put that into perspective, our church property is 2 acres. So we're talking about one city block is Jesus' hometown for his entire growing up years. Nazareth had a maximum population. That size of land could support a maximum number of 480 people, according to some expert I read this week. 480 people. That's a small school. In other words, everybody knows everybody, and they know everything about everybody. So Jesus is going to grow up in a place where everybody, for as long as Jesus lives, they are going to remember the day that the carpenter's family moved from Egypt and had passports stamped with Egyptian passport stamps. As they moved into the neighborhood, they're going to remember that because it's small town, right? Small town life. Everyone knows everyone. And Jesus is going to grow up in the middle of nowhere, and he's going to work in the family business alongside Joseph and his brothers. His sisters are going to marry local boys, and they're going to stay there. You'll actually see that come out in our text today. And Jesus, this is what I want to emphasize. because you probably haven't thought of this before. It occurred to me this week. Jesus comes from and will have the reputation of someone who is completely unremarkable. Jesus is going to grow up in a small town among just another small town person. He's going to be just another small town person. Prior to Jesus' ministry, Jesus himself was a completely unremarkable person. You're going to see that in the text. Look in the text. The reaction Jesus gets when he starts teaching in the local synagogue is that people can't believe that this is what Jesus has become because they know that what he was like when he left home. Jesus was not the rising star, sort of the quarterback who signed the big contract and went off to become rich and famous. That's not their expectation for Jesus, as you can see in the text. Because when Jesus returns, he's going to have an entourage, and he's going to teach in the local synagogue with wisdom. There are going to be deeds of power. And his Sabbath school teachers are going to go, "We remember when," and they're going to take offense at him. Because Jesus was not the rising star in his growing up years. He was a completely unremarkable person. The reaction that they're getting, that they are giving, is because they had different expectations for who Jesus was. He wasn't like this when he left. Where did the wisdom and power come from? They ask. Interestingly, a chapter earlier, the Pharisees go, "Where did Jesus get these abilities, this power? He's casting out demons." And their answer to that question of what's the source of Jesus' power is, Jesus gets this power from Satan. And now his hometown people are asking a similar question. Where does Jesus get this wisdom? Where does Jesus get this ability? Because we remember you growing up. You fixed our fences, and you fixed our roofs, and you helped us out with our farm equipment, and we didn't expect anything like this. Where does this come from? Jesus' father was a carpenter. His father wasn't a rabbi. His father wasn't a prophet. And these people whom Jesus is talking to know him so well that they can name all of his family members right off the top of their heads. They say, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't this Mary's boy? Aren't his brothers with us? James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? Didn't his sisters just marry our boys? The text says that aren't his sisters here among us? They've married into the local village, the other boys there. As you'll see on this screen, this is what two commentators say in response to this. The implication of the list of family details is that a man whose local pedigree is so well known can hardly be thought of as something extraordinary in their eyes. Another commentator says, the primary mistake of the people of Nazareth was their automatic limitation of Jesus to the familiar framework in which they had previously known him. Familiarity with Jesus becomes a liability. This is a hard pill. It's a hard pill for them to swallow. Jesus comes back and he starts teaching his teachers. And they're offended by him. Jesus has changed, and it makes them uncomfortable, and they don't like it. They take offense at who he's become. And Jesus' response is, yep, I kind of saw this coming, because prophets get rejected by those who are closest to them. And it's whole-scale rejection. It's not just the friends and the neighbors and the Sabbath school teachers that taught him growing up. Look at what Jesus says in response. Look at the words. Prophets have no honor in their hometown or among the members of their family. This is the Mary who treasured these things in her heart. These are the brothers that Jesus worked alongside and played alongside growing up. Whole-scale rejection for Jesus. So what can we take from this story? Well, as the commentator has said, familiarity with Jesus has become a liability, and we've seen it now played out in the text. where are we sort of familiar with Jesus and it becomes a liability for us? Well, I'm sure you experience that from time to time as you read the text and you go, I already know this story, and you move on. And next week, the week after, in the coming weeks, we're going to read some pretty familiar stories. Feeding of the 5,000, Jesus walking on water. We're now in the season of Easter. We've heard this story before, haven't we? There's danger in knowing the story, actually. Just going, yeah, I know this, and you move on. We got to be aware of that. Jesus also offends people. People are actually going to be offended by those who look like Jesus. And sometimes that's going to happen right in our own homes, among the members of our family, among our friends, and those who are closest to us. Sometimes home is not actually going to feel like home if you follow Jesus, and other people there don't. That's not really comforting, except in the sense that Jesus himself goes through what you might be going through. If you feel like you can't go home or it's hard to go back there because you follow Jesus, and the people there aren't actually too happy about the fact that you follow Jesus, and they think maybe it's weird or sometimes they get offended by it, Jesus understands that. Jesus is actually going to be rejected there. So the parable of the soils, the hard soil. The hard soil, though, still gets the seed. Jesus still goes, and he still teaches there. Probably some people who were initially on Jesus' side change teams. And when they react to him, it's showing whose team they're really on. Just to speak personally about that, I grew up in a Christian family among a whole bunch of other Christian people. We didn't have any non-Christians in our family, so far as I knew. But as you get a little older, and then maybe you get married, and your family starts to widen, and people get older themselves, you see that some people actually move on or fall off. Or some people just outright reject Jesus. That just started to hit me a couple of months ago, and I've started grieving that sort of internally, and it's something I am still working through. And I just wonder if Jesus is grieving in the same way when he goes home and he doesn't get the reaction that he'd hoped for. The other piece of comfort, though, does come earlier on in the chapter, earlier on in chapter 12, where Jesus' mother and brothers come and see him. And they come to try and bring him out of a house where he's been teaching. And Jesus looks around and he says, actually, it's the people who do God's will who are now my family, my mother and my brothers and my sisters. And I don't know, maybe you have an entirely Christian family where sort of blood family and spiritual family are the same thing to you. And that's wonderful. That's a gift if that's what you have. But Jesus redefines family, and if for you, blood family and spiritual family have now become separate, Jesus still offers you a family. And this is it. And for those of us who are now living sort of away from family support, this has become more meaningful in many, many ways, and we've really needed it, so thank you. What Jesus says is actually coming true, that Jesus takes a group of people who aren't blood and makes them family. And you are a wonderful family to be part of. Jesus' week goes from bad to worse, unfortunately, because after being rejected at home, the next thing that happens in the narrative is that he finds out that his cousin has just been killed, John the Baptist. Herod has just beheaded John the Baptist. Now, this is a different Herod than the one that we talked about in terms of the Christmas story, where Herod slaughters the innocents. The babies. This is his son. That Herod has died. This is his son. His kingdom is broken up into a whole variety of all people, all by going by the name of, annoyingly, Herod. So when you read it in the text, there are actually several different Herods in the Bible. It's really hard to know which one is which. This Herod is known as the Tetrarch. He's known as Herod Antipas. And this Herod went and made the bad decision of divorcing his wife so that he could marry his brother's wife. But in order for him to marry his brother's wife had to divorce Herod's brother. So it's starting to get really, really ugly. And this is both a religious scandal, because you don't divorce someone so that you can go marry someone else. It's a religious scandal. It's also a religious scandal because in Jewish law, you're not allowed to marry your brother's wife. But then it's also a political scandal, because when Herod goes and divorces the wife that he had, he creates a problem with his father-in-law, who is another ruler nearby, and it actually creates a war between them. So when John the Baptist speaks out, he's speaking out against someone who's made religious mistakes and political mistakes, and they have huge implications for the people. And John the Baptist is going to speak out against Herod. And it's not like he takes Herod aside and talks to him privately, and we go, aren't we supposed to do that? Well, actually, John's a prophet. Herod's a public figure. They're both public figures. It's perfectly normal for them to do it in public, but also John doesn't have access to Herod's throne. He's a nobody. He's a prophet out in the desert. So John does the only thing that he can do, and he's making public pronouncements about how what Herod has done is wrong. He's holding him accountable to Jewish law. You're supposedly our king of the Jews. You better live up to it. And he's holding him accountable to it. But from Herod's perspective, this is what's known as sedition, right? He's speaking out against the state. He's speaking out against the ruler. It's speech inciting rebellion. That's what's going on here. And Herod and Herodias want to kill him as a result. But the problem is that he's a really popular prophet. And so they say that that's too politically dangerous for us, but we'll lock him up. So they lock him up, and they start plotting. And whether what goes down as a result is an outright plot that was conceived well in advance or not, or whether Herodias just sees, hey, there's this drunken birthday party happening, and she sends her daughter, and she goes and dances, and then as a result, it doesn't really matter. In the end, John the Baptist is killed. Herod offers his rash words. He can't go back on the promise that he's made. And the girl who dances demands John the Baptist's head on a platter. The disciples come, and they come to bury John the Baptist's body. And then they go and tell Jesus. But if John the Baptist has been speaking out politically against the state, and he's a state criminal being locked up, the disciples coming to bury the body are already taking a risk, because they're now associating themselves with a state criminal. And then they're going to go and tell Jesus, which is going to then associate, in the public's mind, John with Jesus. Of course, they were associated theologically, but now it's come out, and Herod's going to know about the fact that John is connected to Jesus, because the disciples go and they tell Jesus. John's disciples go and tell Jesus about what has happened. Now, we didn't read it, but the very next verse, chapter 14, verse 13, says that Jesus immediately withdraws. He needs some time to think about this, probably to grieve, too. I mean, John the Baptist was the forerunner, but he was also his cousin. So Jesus needs time to think. And as he's thinking, he's going, well, if they do this to the forerunner, what's going to happen to the guy coming next? You see, the retirement plan for prophets is forced retirement by way of unnatural death. That's sort of what happens normally with prophets in Scripture. If you're a good prophet, it's probably not going to go well for you if you are speaking out against corrupt powers. That's the way that this works. And Jesus is thinking through these things. And Jesus is going to have to make some decisions about whether or not he's going to go forward with his plan. John and Jesus continue to do what they do, and they continue to do what they do in the act of taking their lives into their hands. If they continue speaking out, if Jesus continues doing what he does, if John continued doing what he would do, they know the way it's going to end. It's completely predictable. And this is here in this spot in Matthew as a way of foreshadowing what's about to happen to Jesus. If you keep following Jesus, there's going to be rejection. But since most of us in this room are probably not likely to be murdered, let me talk about some other ways that I think that this does apply to us. What about just the little deaths that we may very well all experience and probably will as a result of following Jesus? What about just the death of your popularity or your reputation? If we follow Jesus and act the way that Jesus wants, which is often contradictory to the way the world lives, are we going to have to deal with the fact that it's going to cost me something as far as my reputation goes? Maybe it's going to cost me some money, especially if I'm being honest in my business and I'm not charging things or asking for being paid under the table or something like that. Maybe it's going to make me uncomfortable with my family members, as we heard about earlier. Are we willing to have our story end on a low note, as it does with John the Baptist, and as it's going to with Jesus? I don't know. Do any of you have any questions? We've been talking for a little bit here. Is there something that you want to raise, something that you would like clarified? Has this brought something up for you that you want to talk about? We have maybe a couple minutes. So David's question is asking whether or not John the Baptist's disciples are then going to join Jesus' movement, or if they're going to go off and do their own thing. Do they feel rejected as well? It's hard to know. Some of John the Baptist's disciples, here's why it's hard to know. This description takes place, it's hard to know where this fits in the timeline of Jesus' life, because this has been placed sort of here in the middle of Matthew. But John's arrest happened at the beginning of the story, before Jesus even starts his ministry. But Matthew's doing his own thing. So we see in John, in the Gospel of John, that a couple of John the Baptist's disciples do become Jesus' disciples. But then we also see later on in the New Testament that John the Baptist, some people who had been following John the Baptist, start their own little community. And then Paul's going to show up and go, oh, you haven't received the Spirit yet. You haven't been baptized yet. You only know about John's baptism. Let me tell you the rest of the story. So probably both are happening. Good question. Yeah, Ken?
Was John's death a
Kent is asking, was John the Baptist's death a fulfillment of prophecy, or was it just sort of tough luck? As far as I know, it was not a fulfillment of prophecy. John is described as Elijah, but it's never, as far as I know, in the passages in Malachi that talk about Elijah coming again, it doesn't talk about Elijah dying. It's just the role that he's going to perform in leading the way for, preparing the way for Yahweh himself to come to his people. But at the same time, Jesus is going to say, prophets have a way of dying in Jerusalem. So he's going to bring that up again, and he's going to refer back to John and say that they did to John what they liked. Yep. Kent is asking again, then, is that why John the Baptist is described as the greatest prophet in the Old Testament? I don't know why, actually, Jesus decides to say that all of those other prophets, like Malachi and Elijah and so on, they weren't as good as John the Baptist. I'm not really sure. Good question.
And
maybe because they were cousins, yes. OC? OC's asking if Jesus had any sort of formal training outside of being a carpenter. Jesus' family would have attended synagogue regularly. They would have also made pilgrimages down, 3 days' journey down to Jerusalem a couple of times a year for feasts. But as far as formal training goes, we're not told explicitly if Jesus had formal training. The Jewish schooling, as far as I know, tends to be sort of elementary level, where you learn your letters and some Torah, and then you move on and you go into your particular trade. Jesus is being brought up in sort of the lower end of what we might call middle class. They don't really have it there. But he's a laborer, right? So his primary training is going to be in carpentry as he moves up, as he grows up. Good question.
How does this tie into what Sheila was mentioning about her uncle?
I'm going to get back to that. Thank you. Great. Awesome. Cool. I always enjoy interacting with you. Those are some great questions. How does this relate to Sheila's uncle? Rejection, friends, isn't the end of the story. We didn't read it last week because I want you to do your own homework. But the parable following the parable of the seeds is the parable of what's known as the wheat and the tares, or the wheat and the weeds. I'd like you to go home and read that if you haven't already. Go home and read that. I will offer that by way of a veiled explanation and then come out more explicitly and say this. Acts 1, you're going to see this on the screen. Acts 1, starting at verse 13. After Jesus was taken up into heaven, his disciples returned to Jerusalem. When they had entered the city, they went to the room upstairs where they were staying, Peter and John, James and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus, Simon the Zealot. Zealots were political and religious terrorists, by the way. And then Judas and James. All of these were constantly devoting themselves to prayer together with certain women, including Mary, the mother of Jesus, as well as his brothers, the family members who had rejected him in Nazareth. The hard soil that rejects Jesus can soften. James, the brother of Jesus, is actually going to become the leader of the church. Before Paul, before Peter, it was James, the brother of Jesus. So if you go home and it's hard because you follow Jesus, and if you have prayed for family members the way Sheila has prayed for her uncle, if you're experiencing what I'm going through where some of my family members are walking away, don't give up on the hard-hearted, because apparently God doesn't. So stay faithful and keep praying. Let's pray. Lord, it's not always easy to follow you. Sometimes it costs us, just like it cost your son. In the places and situations in which we find ourselves feeling uncomfortable because we follow you, give us the courage we need and the commitment to follow you, regardless of the cost. And when we feel discouraged by the way our loved ones reject you, help us trust that you are still working, even when it looks hopeless. In your name, amen.